Pursuing your future doesn't end at 40. In fact, it may mark the beginning of knowing who you are, what you're capable of, and
hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What you really want. But knowing what's next and how to get there can be a challenge, especially when old narratives play on repeat. Liberty Road is here to share stories so that you can consider your possibilities, pursue your purpose, and move into your future with intention. I'm your host, Netta Jones, and we're here to listen, learn, and liberate dreams one episode at a time. Well, hello, Liberty listeners. Welcome to another episode of Liberty Road. We're going to set the record straight about all things menopause right here today with Dr. Sharon Malone. I am so excited for this conversation, and it's one that you are going to come back to time and time again. Not only is Dr. Malone an OBGYN, she's the CMO at Aloe Health. She is now the brand new author of Grown Women Talk, and I just can't wait to unpack all of this today. Dr. Sharon, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to the show.
Well, it is truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And I realize in the introduction, I said Dr. Malone, and now I said Dr. Sharon, because everybody I know refers to you as Dr. Sharon.
You know what? It's less formal, so I love it. Okay, Dr. Sharon is just fine.
Okay, then we'll go with that. So here you are. You've been practicing in Washington, D.C. as an OBGYN for 30 years. You are the chief medical officer at Aloe. And then you decide, because you've got nothing else to do, to add author to the mix, and you write this book, Grown Women Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. Tell me why it was important for you to write this book.
I think that being the only doctor in my friend group and also in my family, I spend a lot of time sort of navigating and negotiating, not necessarily just the medical issues, but the how-tos and the ins and outs of how to navigate in this really complicated medical system. And I thought, you know what? If they don't know, what about everybody else who's out there who does not have access to a doctor on speed dial? Perhaps there are some things that you need to know, this grown woman talk, to really give you the tools that you need to be empowered, not only in taking care of your health, but how to get through this system efficiently and effectively.
Tell us about the name, by the way. It's such a great name. Yeah. Where did that come from?
Grown woman talk really came from my upbringing. It is all the conversations that as a child I was asked to leave the room for. You know, when my mother and her sisters would start talking about something and you knew it was about to go in a direction because the voices would get low. And then they'd turn and look at you and they'd say, this is grown folks talk. And then it was your cue to exit the room.
You got to get out of here.
Oh, you had to go. And you were dying to know what they were saying. And I think there is a lot about what they were saying that we needed to hear.
Yeah.
You know, so this is a sort of homage to my mother and her sisters and her friends and all of the conversations that we didn't hear growing up. But we need to talk about them now.
I'm so glad you are bringing them to all of us and through this book specifically. It's so dense. There's so much in it. As I was reading, I was like, I have more questions to ask. I can't wait for this conversation. I also love that you start each chapter with a song, that this is something that apparently I didn't know this about you, but you are a DJ at heart. Why was it important to incorporate that into the book?
I figured that I was going to only write one book. And so I had to put everything that I loved into one book. So I have family stories. I have patient stories. And then there's this thread of music. And I absolutely love music. I love going out for live music. I like finding new music. And those who know me know that I really have a song for everything. It's like, oh, there's a situation, I have a song for that. And I wanted to share that because I think if I hadn't been a doctor, I think what I would like to do most of all, I would have been a talent scout. I would have been out there looking for new music. And barring that, I would have settled for being a DJ. And that's my role now. I'm just the resident DJ.
Well, you definitely got your DJ on in the book. I had a good laugh around some really heavy topics. You were throwing it in and there was some lovely levity as I was reading through. So thank you for that.
We talk about tough stuff in the book. You know, we talk about cancer. We talk about heart disease. And the perspective that I really wanted to have is to let you know that this isn't just a doctor lecturing to you about, you know, do this, do that. And if you just follow my advice, you'll be good. I want you to know that I wrote this book actually from the perspective of I'm a sister, I'm a friend, I'm a daughter. So these are not just things that I talk about from a medical point of view. They're things that I tell. There are a lot of personal stories about my family because I get it. And I get it in a way that I want you to understand that I see you, I feel you.
Even in your chapter, the beginnings of your chapter, referring to us as cis and making it a community that's having a kitchen table conversation, if you will. There's also a point in time that I want to refer to. About 3.5 years ago, you were on a podcast with your dear friend, Michelle Obama. You guys start talking about menopause, and it seems like you guys triggered something. It was a watershed moment. What do you think that conversation shook up for all of us? Or why do you think it shook it up for all of us? Why was that so pivotal?
I think for time immemorial, women have spent a lot of effort denying where we were in life. You know, you're trying to be younger. It's anti-aging. Let's pretend. Let's do all the things to deny the space that we're in right now. And anything that really gave voice to the fact that we're older and things are different, we avoided those conversations. And I think it was liberating when Michelle Obama said, hey, I had a hot flash on Marine One, and this is what happened to me. It all of a sudden, I think there was a collective sigh of relief where everybody says, you too? We can talk about this. And that's the beauty of having people, public figures, talk about menopause, is that it normalizes the conversation. And it also makes you understand that this is not something to be ashamed of. This is a universal experience that every person born with ovaries will experience. Now, we may experience it a little differently. Yours may be different from mine, but the end result, we're all going to end up at the same place. I think that it just burst open the floodgates. Yeah. And now we can't stop talking about menopause. No. And that's a good thing.
And you invited more conversation with Oprah and with Tracy Ellis Ross. And the reason I bring those two into this conversation is there's a through line here that you were talking to Black women. And in your book, you really focus, although it's for everybody, you really focus on Black women. Why did you want to address this population in particular? And again, I just want to say the book is for everybody. I found so much in it for me. You're not left out if you're not a Black woman, but you do such a good job of addressing that population.
I wrote from that perspective because that's who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just point of view. And I think that the assumed point of view is always that of the majority of population, a white woman or a white man who's writing. And we read books from white people all the time. We take, you know, information from that. But it was important to me to carve out a little piece of it to say that when I'm talking about a particular statistic, I want to say specifically, this is what it is generally, and this is what it is for you, because I don't think that there's been enough conversation about that that really addresses some of the unique issues about Black women in this country. You know, that's who I am. I grew up around Black women. I'm one of five sisters. So that perspective was important. But I was telling someone, they said, well, your book is called Grown Woman Talk. And I said, well, you know what? Actually, the first third and the last third of my book could apply to men. There's nothing about my book that in the beginning and the end that couldn't apply to everyone. But I want people to understand, and all women to understand, that we have been underserved, mm-hmm. we have been under-researched, I think we've been ignored and marginalized in this conversation, generally, and you take that on steroids, and that's where Black women fall in these conversations. So I just want you to say, hey, sis, I see you.
Yeah. There's something else that shocked me, actually, in the book, and it was the part where you talk about it was in the 90s, that women were actually starting to be studied, that we were the subject of our own health. What the heck? Why?
I know.
Why?
I know. What the heck? It wasn't until 1993 that it was mandated that women be included in NIH-funded studies. Now, think about that. The 90s were, you know, I mean, I can reach back and touch the 90s, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
When you don't have a diverse study population, and you don't have diverse researchers, who is included and why they're included in studies is heavily dependent upon the powers that be that decide, why should we research this? And let me say, we spend a lot of time describing women's issues. We use the language of suffering to describe our experience. We suffer from migraines. We suffer from cramps. We suffer through childbirth, through bad relationships. That's a lot of misery that's sort of woven into the experience of being women. Well, and I say, well, why is that? And more importantly, what are we going to do about it? And that requires someone to be curious about women's health issues. And another statistic that I think that women should really be aware of, and this is where I want you to wake up about this, is that the 2022 budget at NIH, you know, they fund, they're a major funder of research in this country. They had a $45 billion budget. And of that $45 billion, less than 11% of it was dedicated to conditions or diseases that primarily affect women. Hello, it's 2024. Why don't we have research, more research into fibroids? Why don't we have research into endometriosis? And for goodness sake, why don't we have more research into menopause? Because, as again, you may have those other things, but menopause is the universal experience of being born female in this country. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say this. 1993 was also a pretty important moment because that was the first time we ever had a female director of NIH. So I don't think it was a coincidence that the largest study that was ever done on postmenopausal women, the Women's Health Initiative, was initiated during the time of Bernardine Healy, Dr. Bernardine Healy. And we have to give her a little credit. And I think that that's when her perspective said, you know, hey, why aren't women included in studies? So it matters who sits in the seat and who's making the decisions. When it gets back to why diversity is important, it's because what you find interesting to study depends on who's asking the questions and who's funding the research. Those are pretty important points.
And let's talk about Dr. Healy for a second, because although she started that study, she wasn't there at the end to summarize the study, and it kind of went sideways. Talk to us about that study going sideways and how for the last 20 years we've been relying on some bad information.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Dr. Healy was not there to see it through. And I don't know the details, but she didn't leave under the best circumstances when she left NIH. And again, we can attribute that to a lot of things, but it's hard when you're trying to deal with the patriarchy. And here's a woman, and she was not a shrinking violet by any stretch of the imagination. And I would imagine that ruffled a few feathers away, but not to go into that.
Yeah.
But
another podcast.
Another podcast. What could have possibly gone wrong there, right?
Exactly.
But the Women's Health Initiative, I think, had very laudable goals, very poorly executed. Because the question that they were trying to answer, which made sense, let me just go back a little bit and say about hormone replacement therapy, it's not new. It's been around since 1942. So the basics of hormones, like does it relieve the symptoms of menopause? Yeah, we know that. We had 50 years of experience with hormones at that point. And we had even worked out a few kinks about what we were doing wrong about prescribing hormones. Oh, you can't give estrogen by itself. It needs to be given with a progestin because that little pesky thing about endometrial cancer. Okay, so we figured that out. But with all of this experience, this 50 years of experience with using hormones, one of the things that we did find in observational studies is that they were just watching this, it's called the nurses study, and they just watched these nurses for 25 years, and they started when they were young and followed them through menopause and beyond, and they found out, wow, look at this, the women who took estrogen had half the risk of heart disease of the women who didn't take estrogen. Amazing. So, and it wasn't the only study, but there was a lot of observational data. And you can't really prove correlation with observational studies, but you can at least say, well, that's interesting. That is all pointing in the same direction. So the Women's Health Initiative was supposed to actually answer the question definitively, does hormone therapy decrease the risk of heart disease? Mm-hmm. And if that were true, that would have been huge. Because more women die of heart disease every year than from all cancers combined. So if you could decrease the risk of heart disease, that would be fantastic, right? So that was what the study was supposed to do. But here's the rub, and this is why I said a little poorly designed. The study was only supposed to last for 8 years. And what we do know just about how heart disease works in women have half the risk of heart disease as men until menopause. But it takes about 10 years before you start to see the risk of heart disease for women equal that or exceed that of men. It takes 10 years. So you can't start the study when someone's 50 when we would normally prescribe it because it would take you, you know, another 15 years to see the difference. So they said, ha, what if we had women who were older? And that's why the population was skewed. The average age of the women in that study was 63, and they were more than 10 years beyond the date of their natural menopause. So it wasn't like the study we looked at women where we're looking at them at 50 and watch you until you're 65. We're just starting at 65. And the problem there is that how can you prove prevention when you give the intervention after people already have the thing that you're trying to prevent? You see, sure. I mean, so that was the fundamental flaw. And then because women could be in this study even up to age 79. So I would dare say you couldn't prevent heart disease in a 79-year-old, no matter what you gave them. You know, probably if you gave them a new heart, you couldn't prevent it. But that was the fundamental flaw. But then it was compounded because even though they knew that this was not typical of women who were starting hormone therapy, they extrapolated that data to all women. So it wasn't just, if you had just said, well, if you're 63 and more than 10 years beyond menopause, it doesn't decrease your risk of heart disease. That is true. But they extrapolated that data to all women, all ages. They only had one type of hormone. It wasn't even as if they used different doses. They didn't use different types. It was one preparation, one dose. And from that, they painted all hormones with a very broad brush and women of all ages. And we have come to find out now in sort of re-examining that data that that's not true. It matters when you start hormones. If you're going to prevent a disease, well, how about let's start it before you get it?
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
after, you know, it's closing the barn door after the horse is already out. And so that was the first problem. The second biggest piece of it was when they said that it increased the risk of breast cancer by 26%. That was the nail in the coffin on the hormone study. But even that is not really an accurate statement. It was not statistically significant. And what they forgot to tell you, oh yeah, by the way, and we can argue about whether or not that's even true. That's for another podcast.
Yeah.
But even from the Women's Health Initiative, for the women who had had hysterectomies, so they could take estrogen only because you don't need progestin unless you have a uterus. For those women, they found, guess what? 20 years of follow-up, and we look back and we found that the women who took estrogen only, even these older women, all of that, their incidence of breast cancer decreased by 23%, and the risk of dying from breast cancer, even if you got it, is down by 40%. So where was that press conference? Did anyone come out and say, you know what, actually, the estrogen actually prevents breast cancer in women who've had hysterectomies? So that whole thing, it was a PR disaster that we are still recovering from almost 22 years later.
It's a medical disaster.
It's a medical disaster.
If you think of all the people who've been suffering, I have peers who will say the same thing. My doctor will not prescribe anything for me because they're relying on a study that's 20 years old. And we know that in med school, you can tell me better than I can tell the audience, menopause is like a day at school. It's not a practiced thing.
That's the real harm in the Women's Health Initiative, because to be honest with you, for someone who was actually practicing 10 years before that study came out, during the disastrous time of having to explain to your patients why you're trying to kill them, because that's what they thought. Wow. When I read the study, and this is back in 2002, I said, oh my God, that wasn't that bad, because the flaws were evident immediately. These women are starting at 63. They're older. Oh, by the way, what does a 26% increase in breast cancer even look like?
Yeah.
And it found out that when you use statistics like that, you say a 26% increase, it sounds like a big number. But the reality is, when you put it in real terms, that only was the equivalent of less than 1 per 1,000 women per year in the women who took the estrogen and progestin. So when you say a 26% increase, that sounds like huge. But when you say, well, taking estrogen is only, you know, maybe 1 in 1,000 women,
right,
additional cases of breast cancer, then it doesn't sound that bad. And that, I think, never got explained fully.
Yeah, and that these women didn't die of cancer, like in addition to.
Exactly.
Yeah, and their age. I mean, there's got to be some data around that 60, 70-year-old age of those women that had been studied and their proclivity to breast cancer.
Right.
There must be something there too.
Yeah. And this is something that I think women don't really understand, is that you have to say, what is your biggest risk factor for developing breast cancer? It's not your family history. Mm-hmm. It's not whether or not you take hormones. It's age. Your risk of breast cancer goes up with each decade of life.
Yeah.
Now, if you tell them that, it's like, well, we can't do anything. We can't turn back the hands of time. So, you know, just understand that your risk increases with age. But here's also the good news. The aggressiveness of the cancer, the older you are, the less aggressive type. So that's why screening is so important. Getting breast exams is so important, is because most women, over 90% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer today, will live.
Yeah.
That was not the case 40 years ago, 50 years ago, because of early screening and early intervention and treatment.
Which, again, builds a case for everything you say in the book about sort of advocating for ourselves. Let me back up on two things really quickly. Can you just set the record straight once and for all? What is perimenopause? What is menopause? And what is postmenopause? Or is postmenopause a thing?
Is it a thing? Okay, I'll tell you my opinion about
the
postmenopause.
Let's hear your opinion.
But perimenopause is pretty clear. Perimenopause just simply means around the menopause. It doesn't have a clear demarcation the way menopause does. And perimenopause can begin anywhere from 4 to 10 years prior to having had your last period. So menopause itself is defined as when you have had your last menstrual period. Well, you don't know when that is. When's your last one? But it is confirmed when you've gone 12 consecutive months and you haven't had another period. Then you say, official, you're menopausal. But those before times, if I tell you the average age for having had your last period in this country is 51, that means that as early as 41, you can be perimenopausal. What if your last period is going to be at 45? Then that means that for some women, they can start having symptoms in their 30s. And the things that we associate with menopause, we think of, oh, well, that's just old ladies, right? And I'm here to tell you, no, all of these things start happening, some in your mid-30s, but certainly for 90% of women, they're going to happen somewhere between about 40 and 50. And all of the things that we normally associate with menopause, like the hot flashes and mood swings and the other 30-plus symptoms that you can have, you have them. You can have them even when your periods are regular. And that is why I think it's so confusing and misleading for women, and why it, and even for doctors, because they will start saying, well, it can't be menopause because your periods are regular. I'm like, you're perimenopausal. If I don't, we don't need a blood test. I don't need a sonogram or a soothsayer. If you're between the ages of 40 and 50, regardless of what's happening with your periods, you are perimenopausal, because that says on average you're within 10 years of your last period.
Okay, so then is there a postmenopausal thing? Or is it just you're in menopause until you die?
You know, I don't like the term postmenopausal because it implies that you're over it. The message that I keep giving women is that regardless of whether your symptoms are gone, suppose you had hot flashes or suppose you never had hot flashes, the effects of the estrogen, the lack of estrogen, will continue to affect you from for the rest of your life. So it's implying that, oh, I'm over it. Oh, you know, I stopped having hot flashes. I'm over menopause. No, you're not. Menopause is still doing things to your cardiovascular system. It is still doing things to your brain. It is still doing things to your bone, your muscles. So that's why I don't like the term postmenopause, even though it's used. I get it, what it's for, but that's just a personal quirk of mine, because I want you to think about menopause as being the entire rest of your life after you've had your last menstrual period. You're never over it.
And then in that case, also perhaps still needing hormones, right? We don't think of that, well, I haven't had my period for 10 years, I should be fine. You can still be symptomatic and need hormones to deal with those things, correct?
You can still be symptomatic. And again, it depends on what your risk factors are for cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis, because to date, hormone therapy is the only medication that is FDA approved for the prevention of osteoporosis. Mm. So if you take hormones between 50 and 60 and you say, oh, I've been on 10 years, I'm going to stop now, just arbitrarily, well, you will start to lose bone again from 60. Suppose you're going to live to be 85 or 90. That bone loss will start to accelerate again, and that whatever the protection that you had for those first 10 years will rapidly dissipate. So again, depending upon your what your risk factors are, what your personal preference is, quality of life is not an insignificant reason to take hormones. We get to do a lot of things for quality of life. And I think that when you talk to a woman who is very symptomatic and who's not sleeping, I think we could argue that she would say, yeah, it's worth it.
Absolutely.
It's worth it.
Absolutely. I want to ask about stopping hormones, and specifically with osteoporosis. But one thing, when I heard you talk, when we first met in Los Angeles, you said something that sort of blew my mind about when we are, for those of us who were on birth control, we were taking hormones. But somehow, when we think about HRT or we talk to our doctors who are not advocates of it, it's like a no-no. We have been on hormones. What's the gap there? Why a gap?
Not only have you been on hormones, but even if you haven't taken birth control pills, you have been under the influence of estrogen and progesterone for your entire reproductive life. So how is it so terrible now and it was fine when you were younger? And the reality is that for most women, they think of hormone therapy, again, as being separate and apart from birth control pills. Mm-hmm. But they also think that it's more. But the amount of estrogen that you take to control symptoms and to get the benefit is anywhere from a half to a quarter the dose of what you took in birth control pills, even the low-dose birth control pills. So you're like, oh, yeah, but I'm not taking those hormones. They're dangerous. They're not.
And I mean, I'm sure this is a part of the work you're doing through your book and through Alloy, but it seems like doctors need to be re-educated, right? Because I have, again, friends whose doctors are saying, no, we're not going to go there. I'll tell you a situation that just happened. A friend of mine was in the hospital, unfortunately, with a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. This was only a few weeks ago. And when the doctor was explaining everything to her, she had said, I'm on HRT. Her particular case, it's the pellet. And he said, you should really read up. Not, he didn't give her advice on it. He said, you should really read up on the effects of that. I thought that was really irresponsible as a doctor to throw something out there with no facts. Why didn't the doctor know more about that? Why didn't the doctor have more information about that for her?
Well, you know, there are two things. That same information vacuum that happened post Women's Health Initiative, mm-hmm. where women were not given information about hormones, there's an entire generation of doctors that was not trained about hormones and what it means. So if you have a doctor, I'd say anywhere between the ages of about 40 and 55, chances are they have no idea because they weren't taught. And they grew up in that same environment thinking that hormones are dangerous and they're terrible and they're going to cause cancer. So there's that. Now, once you get outside the circle of OBGYNs, and now there are a fair number of OBGYNs in that category too, that same age group that don't know about hormones. Once you start expanding that concentric circle and you go internal medicine doctors, oh, they know less and less and less and less, because not only were they not taught, they're not even thinking about it. And they are reading the same sort of headlines that patients have been reading. But here's something that I think is curious to me, is that when it comes to hormone therapy, other specialties of medicine love to weigh in on hormone therapy. And I find that curious. Here's my theory. OBGYN is now about 90% female, the most female-centric subspecialty. Well, if you're an internal medicine doctor or if you're anything else, why do you feel as if you have the right to opine about another doctor's experience? You suppose you've got a great doctor and they gave you a prescription and you go in and you talk to your internist or your neurologist and they say, oh, you need to get off that stuff. I have never in all of my years stepped in about, unless it's something, you know, really egregious. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Let's say that. Yeah. But said, you know what, you're on that medicine for high blood pressure. I think you should stop taking that, or whatever it is. I respect my colleagues. You're taking it for whatever reason. And if I have an issue, I'm going to talk to them. Yeah. I would never talk to a patient or change someone's course of therapy because of what? I just thought it was a bad idea, because we know they're not coming from data. There's no science behind what they're saying. And I think that there's just a certain reluctance that, because you've got a double whammy for women. You're talking about a woman patient, and 9 times out of 10, there's usually a woman who's prescribed. So there's a certain license, I think, that doctors take about opining about other people's care. This is a true story. I've been on hormone therapy for, look, I went straight from birth control pills to hormone therapy. I was like, hot flashes look really uncomfortable. I believe it. Yeah. I had a couple of them, you know, just to see. And I was like, ooh, yeah, that sucks.
I don't want to do that again.
You know?
Yeah. No.
And you know what? And I say this, and I've said this before. I'm just not a fan of suffering. I'm like, you know what? Tell me that this is going to be over in 10 years or so. No, thank you. I can't have the brain fog. I do a job that requires me to be on my toes. I want to feel a certain way. Sexual function is important. So yes, I've made decisions for me about whether or not to do hormones. That's number one. And to give you an idea of how this works, I saw a new internist a couple of years ago. And she asked me, she said, okay, what medications do you take? And I said, I went through everything. And then she goes, and I said, well, I'm taking hormones. And she said, she looked at me, she says, you know, I'm not a fan. Mm. And I was like, did I ask you? Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out. But if you're saying that to me, then I know that whatever conversation you're having with another woman who comes in, you are saying whatever that is much more strongly worded language than you would to me. And this is what's happening to women all along. Even when they find a provider, they go see someone else and they kind of talk them out of it.
And this is, again, back to your book and back to being an advocate. And let me go back to something we addressed earlier when you talked about a Black population of women who didn't believe they could advocate for themselves, who took the doctor's word if they even went to the doctor. What do you think that particular population needs to know, needs to be armed with in going to see their doctor?
If you are going to go to your doctor, the more information you have, then the better you're able to advocate for yourself. And that's why I said they're just things that you don't know. And women in general, that happens. Then you have to deal. But as a Black woman, in addition to just the lack of general knowledge, there is real bias. There are things that we're taught in medicine that we just took for granted. Well, it's like, well, if someone said it, it must be true. That are particular biases about Black women. Here's an example. I was taught that Black women, their hot flashes weren't as bad. Not true. They're worse. I was also told that Black women don't get osteoporosis. Not true. Whether or not you get osteoporosis depends on what is your frame like. It has nothing to do with the color of your skin. Residents still think in the 2000s that Black people have different pain tolerance than white people. I mean, these are things that we learn in medical school. This is not just hearsay. Even some of the medical tests are weighted for race because they're saying, well, kidney function is different in Black people, lung function. And it's sort of like, this is pseudoscience here. That's what we learned in med school, and that's what we bring forward. So in addition, when I think that there is a triple whammy when it comes to Black women, because it's just a lack of awareness and education about what you're supposed to be advocating for. You get there, you see your provider, and that person is not going to even address this because they have their own issues about what they think for you. And even when sometimes you find someone that will address them, then you're afraid because there's the mistrust factor between doctors and patients. And the cultural competency issue is real. That's why I said one of the reasons why when I wrote my book, I really wanted to address that because we have got to come to grips with the fact that, you know, race is a social construct. It is not a biological construct. And so many of the things that we attribute to race really have to do more with environment, what we call the social determinants of health. Poor outcomes, yes, there are poor outcomes for African-American people in this country, but it's because of where you live, the air you breathe, your lack of access to quality health care, the quality of your food, lack of a safe neighborhood. All of these things determine your health outcomes, but we attribute them to race. I want people to understand the difference here. So you've got to put all of that into that, you know, equation when you're looking at health outcomes. You know, it gets back to what I was saying before about women, about who finds things interesting to study. And I say, we spend so much time in this country discussing the disparities. Okay, it's a disparity. It's the same disparity now that it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and in some instances, it's getting worse. Why do we never get to the next step? Okay, why? You know, what are those other things that are causing problems? And many of those we do know. But more importantly, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
And that's where we sort of fall dangerously short. When I hear things about health disparities, I'm like, yeah, that is true. There is a health disparity issue in this country. But I want to use this as an opportunity to be empowering, to say to women, okay, all right, yes, it is. But let me give you the things that you can do right here, right now, today, while we're waiting on the entire structure of medicine and all that to change. In the meantime, we can do two things at once. But I want you to know, I don't want you to throw your hands up in despair and say, oh, it's because of that too, or this runs in my family. No, I want you to take back some of that control and realize that you've got way more than you think, and it has nothing to do with the color of your skin.
Yeah. Amen. This book, I mean, thank you for your personal stories. Thank you for dispelling the stories around HRT. Thank you for the chapters that begin with songs. But most of all, man, thank you for giving us back agency with regard to our health, for calling us to task on really caring for ourselves. And also, my hope is, Dr. Sharon, that other medical providers hear what you're doing and that this begins another watershed moment of doctors not reading the headlines as practitioners, but really looking at the data and what it means and how to read it so that we can care for this population of women. In the book, you talk a lot about knowing your medical history and genetics and things like that. If we don't have family members, my parents were the only ones that immigrated. My father has passed. Where do I go to get that information? Is it a 23andMe thing? Is there a place for me to go to find that out?
Well, you know what? I say it's good to know. I come from a family that I don't know much beyond my immediate family and my parents. Not much more than that, because it just wasn't knowable. People didn't talk about it, and nobody was diagnosing anything anyway. It's like, okay. Right. It's helpful if you have it. Your family history is important because it might identify propensities. Mm-hmm. Most diseases are not genetic. And that's the thing I want you to understand, because we share more as family members in terms of our environment, our diet, our habits, our lifestyle, than we do the gene part of it. That's really maybe only 5 to 10% of things are actually genetically transmitted. It's a small subset, even when you're talking about cancer. So I want you to know what things you need to look out for, because there's a signpost. If you say, look, my mother, my father had high blood pressure, they have diabetes, whatever it is that you can do, and you have a lot in your control to sort of stop before you get there. I like analogies, you know, that if you read the book.
Yeah, I love it.
Because it helps you understand. If you're on a road and there's a sign up that says, bridge out ahead, do you put your foot on the gas and keep going? Because you're going to fall off the cliff, right? But what if you say, it says, bridge out ahead, and you go, oh, well, maybe I'll take my foot off the gas. Or better still, how about I turn the car around and take another route? That's what your family history really tells you. It tells you what things that are warning signs, that things that people in your family do. If you continue to do those same things, you will end up off that bridge as well. But short of that, the earlier you find out that that's a problem for you, the more opportunity you have. Yeah. So it's no throw your hands up in despair moment. It's an opportunity to say, wow, I see where this is going. Let me intervene early and often to make sure that I don't end up there.
That's super helpful. I feel like that was a mind shift right there. What you did was help us understand this 5 to 10% that's genetic. I had no idea. And then also that it's so much about environment. What are the things that they experience that I experienced growing up in that home, or the habits that I took with me that are playing into my health? Thank you so much for that. I have to ask you, you've written this book. It's really start to finish, from birthing years all the way to the end years. You talk about living your best healthy life. What, in your medical point of view, are maybe three things we can do to live our best, physically speaking, our best midlife?
They're so basic and so simple. And I find a different way to say it each time, but it's basically exercise. Exercise is so important, staying physically active. And you don't exercise to lose weight. So dispel that notion. No, that's not why you exercise. It improves your mood. It helps your muscle mass. It helps your bone mass. It helps your brain. It helps your heart. It decreases the risk of cancer. So there are just a million reasons why you need to exercise, weight being the least of them.
Yeah.
Get a good night's sleep. Because I tell you, not getting sleep, and this is where we get back to the hormone issues, particularly for women who are not sleeping because of these chronic debilitating hot flashes, treat them. Because lack of sleep is an independent risk factor, not only for cardiovascular disease, it increases your risk for hypertension and weight gain. None of these things occur in isolation. Absolutely. Because when you don't sleep and you are chronically fatigued, you make poor choices the next day. Mm-hmm. You're going to eat more. You're going to exercise less because you're fatigued. Don't think of any of these in isolation. They all go together. So sleep, exercise, and your diet matters. Don't let anybody tell you that it doesn't. And I say this, I'm not the food police. I have ice cream when I feel like having ice cream.
Is it your mother's ice cream recipe or is it Breyer's ice cream? Because I read that.
Oh, I so wanted the Breyer's. And I was like, oh, Mom, this ice, she would be making ice cream. And I was like, it's not even that hard. You know, it would be soft serve ice cream. To this day, I don't like soft serve ice cream.
For that reason.
I want the frozen, you know, in a block kind. But it is just a matter of understanding that how we eat, that there is a concept that food is medicine, and what you put in your body, processed foods thrown in from time to time, but try to do better about our diets because it truly affects everything, our weight, our mood. So I said, those would be my top three. I have some others, and they're just making sure that you're paying attention and monitoring the conditions that you do have.
Thank you for that. And please, everyone, get the book because you list so many of those out there. This is such an important topic for you. This is something that you are not only advocating for in talking to people like me, in writing the book, but you have gone on to be the chief medical officer at Alloy. Why was that important for you?
I wasn't planning to do that at all. I pretty much got to the end of my career, said, I think I'm done. I left, walked away. And I realized, I said, you know, I could do this job because it's not asking me to do anything that differently that I've been doing. Mm. Menopause has always been a big part of my practice. The older you are, the more interesting menopause gets, by the way. But it's always been a part of my practice, always been something that I've been counseling my patients on preemptively. I would start talking about menopause with my patients in their early 40s because I was like, well, I don't know if you know this, but this is going to happen. And so when it happens, they're not surprised by it, I should say. Right. It was an opportunity because I realized that there's a huge dearth of practicing physicians who know how to do this. And with telehealth, it really gives you a unique opportunity to leverage the expertise of a few over many women. What about all those women out there in America who don't even have an OBGYN, much less a menopause-trained OBGYN?
Yeah.
And that accessibility gap is getting larger and larger. And we're going to have to use vehicles like telehealth. And I said, well, you know, well, who better to do this than me? Because I know what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah.
I know how to create a menopause protocol for a telehealth company. And so that's sort of how I got to that. But it really was not planned. Monica and Anne, the founders of Alloy, found me, believe it or not, from the Michelle Obama podcast.
I believe it.
They
I believe
did.
It. Yeah, they're wonderful. And boy, are they smart, too, to have snagged you up.
They really are.
I'm so glad that you're doing the work that you're doing there. And we'll make sure to have myalloy.com and your book, Grown Women Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy, in the show notes. Please go out and get this book. By the way, I have no skin in the game. I'm not pushing this book because I get a penny. It's because it's such a great book. It's such an easy read, and you will learn so much about your own health. So before I let you go, I have one last question. Your work as now an author, as a CMO, as an OBGYN for 30 years has done so much to liberate so many other people. What has it done to liberate you?
Oh my God, the freedom of being able to do what I want to do because I genuinely find it interesting to me. Mm. I'm at the point in my life now where there are no more have to's. There's only want to's. And that is extremely liberating to be at this point. So I want to tell all these women out there who are dreading menopause and thinking that being older is a terrible thing, I have never had more fun. And that is because the liberating effect of not having children in the house, oh, it's huge, you know?
Yeah.
Of not having to get up and go to work. I work on my time and my schedule, and I love it. So don't dread getting older. It is really something to look forward to. So that's why I want you to stay healthy so you can enjoy it.
Amen. Amen to that. Thank you, Dr. Sharon, for coming on and spending this time with us. I so appreciate it.
You are so welcome.
And Liberty listeners, thank you all for joining me and for joining Dr. Sharon. And we will talk to you guys next week. Bye for now.
Liberty Road is broadcast on all platforms: Apple Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcast, and more. If you like what you've heard, please follow, rate, and review Liberty Road on Apple Podcast and Spotify. It helps us to know if these episodes are inspiring and equipping you to move into your middle third with intention. Liberty Road is created by executive producer Netta Jones, supervising producer Elizabeth Windham, producer Julia Windham, and music by Jack Jones.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.